is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Malcolm Holmline, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, just returned from Ukraine, from Kyiv, where he participated in memory of Baba Yar. Malcolm, what was Baba Yar, and what did you learn in this most recent honor to those who died at Baba Yar?
Oh, thank you. Good to be back with you. And indeed, it was a very moving, emotional, but also educational experience from you, who has read about this and, you know, followed it and discussed it on the show in past years. This was the 80th anniversary of the Baba Yar massacre, when 33,711 Jews were killed in 2 days, September 29th to the 30th of 1941, when Nazis and the local collaborators murdered these people, and ultimately 100,000 people, Jews, Roma, Christians, even some Muslims, I think, were killed there. But this is called the Holocaust of Bullets because they were shot. This wasn't done by gas. This wasn't, you know, some sort of distant operation. But the people had to actually line up and shoot 24 hours a day around the clock, men, women, and children. And the and much of this, it was covered over. And when the Russians occupied the area, they destroyed any semblance, any remembrance of it. In fact, it was some construction over the site. Now you can still see the ravine where the bodies were placed, and a variety of memorials now are being erected, including a synagogue in the shape of a book that's called a pop-up synagogue because it can be moved, but it's really quite attractive. A crystal wailing wall that I saw, which was a 75 large quartz crystals in a 40 meter long, about 130 foot long wall of black anthracite. This is very impressive. And there are other, all sorts of other things, including one platform which shot full of bullet holes with the bullet, the same kind of guns that were used to kill the Jews. And it's an attempt, and I have to say, the President Zelensky of Ukraine and people, the mayor, whom we met, the mayor of Kyiv, who very impressive, very tall, about six, I guess, seven, eight, nine. He and his brother, both boxers. Brother was a middleweight, heavyweight champion for about 10 years. Very committed to this. And many people turned out. The President of Germany, President of Israel, joined in this ceremony. And, you know, it's beginning to compensate for all the years of neglect and the attempts to whitewash history, and particularly the Patrick Dubois, a Catholic priest who has spent decades searching for these marked mass graves, unmarked mass graves. And people poo-pooed his efforts, and now he is being celebrated for really having brought all these things to the fore over the years. But you saw people of all faiths really coming together. The Speaker of the House of Georgia was there, other dignitaries, to pay tribute to those who were killed, but also to learn the lessons, and that history can't be erased unless you want to face those same things in the future.
In Ukraine, where we don't have to underline too hard the fact that Ukraine faces unknowns in its immediate future, celebrating the unknowns of the 20th century. We go now to the story of why the foreign minister, Mr. Lapid, is traveling from Israel to Washington. What's up, Malcolm?
Well, Mr. Lapid is coming to Washington, where there will be three-way meetings between Secretary Blinken, our Secretary of State, the UAE Foreign Minister, Abdullah bin Zayed, and the Foreign Minister of Israel, Mr. Lapid. And they will be strengthening the Abraham Accords. There will be bilateral meetings between each of the parties. But there will be the collective meeting, which is, I think, an important statement by the administration that has been accused of, you know, walking away from the Abraham Accords or not giving priority, that this is one of a number of things that they have done recently to show the significance they attach to the follow-up to the Abraham Accords and building the ties between the countries in the region, normalization, as they put it. And I think that this is one of a number of signs and signals that are being sent to other parties who are operative in the region, that the United States remains committed to it. The fact that you had a meeting with the Bahraini foreign minister and Mr. Lapid when he visited Bahrain last week together on a ship, a U.S. Warship, part of the Fifth Fleet that's based at Bahrain. So these are important messages coming at a time when, you know, people raise a lot of questions, when there's increased tension, concern regarding Russia, China, Iran, Turkey, others, and their activities, that we reinforce the message to our allies and to those who want to undermine it.
Let's go to those bad actor allies, the Axis side. Iran's enrichment program. Where is the Vienna conversation, Malcolm? Is it coming back? Because there have been ambiguous statements for weeks about it.
Yes, that's where it is. And they continue to make ambiguous statements, although they did say that the nuclear talks would resume very soon, although they didn't give any dates. This came from the foreign minister, Amir Alian, who said this to reporters just a couple of days ago, but he wouldn't give a specific date. They keep holding out the promise of returning, but have conditioned it. And when they're talking about returning, they're not talking about talks with the U.S. They're talking about Britain, China, France, Germany, and Russia, who are still part of the JCPOA, and not with – they refuse to negotiate directly with U.S. officials. So the hope is that they can – that under hardliner Ibrahim Raisi, the new prime minister – new president of Iran, that they will actually want to come back to compliance. I think it's a – you know, it's a fool's errand because he has spoken against it in every way. But their economic conditions are deteriorating. I've spoken to people there. It's worse than ever. And they are desperate for foreign assistance and for releasing some of the sanctions and the aid that is being money that is being held in foreign accounts, including South Korea. This would be the biggest mistake we could make now. We have this very extreme regime under tremendous pressure. We should keep them that way. That's the only way we're going to get meaningful movement on their part. And so the U.S. has put new sanctions periodically, and we have to continue to apply them and make sure that they're imposed. There's been a lot of talk about Iranian and Saudi having, quote, constructive, unquote, talks, and that Tehran put forward some proposals regarding the war in Yemen, but we have not seen any change on that front either. So meanwhile, Iran has produced more than 265 pounds of 20% enriched uranium. You remember they weren't supposed to go above 3.67%, and I think it was supposed to be a maximum of less than half of that amount. And if you remember, when we last discussed this, I think it was in September, they had 185 pounds of this enriched uranium, up from 138 pounds in May. Now we're talking about a quantum leap, because you don't have to have much more in enriched uranium than the 265 pounds in order to build a bomb. And I think it's 375 pounds altogether that you need. So they're showing that they have the ability to enrich. They're making progress all the time. And in the meantime, they, you know, mock us by holding out the promise but not moving on the negotiations. And the West has to really maintain a hard stand. It's what I heard throughout the UN week from foreign ministers from the region and elsewhere, who recognize that the danger that Iran poses, both with its conventional weapons, which we'll discuss, but also the rapid advance in this nuclear program.
Drones, Malcolm. I believe the report in the Washington Times points to Iran exporting its drones to terrorist organizations. Who's working on this, Malcolm? Who is attempting to stop this proliferation?
Wow. Attempting to stop it? Not many. But this is really changing, in some respects, the military lineup in the region. And I say it because the Air Force of Iran, we know, has been very weak. It's very antiquated. It has not been updated in a long time. And yet we see that they are now investing so much into the drone program and having a whole series of different drones that are active, that they can activate and have been using. And we see that they're using them now, as they did in the Yemen war and in attacks against Saudi Arabia, if you recall, and the danger of them exporting the drones. We know that their Iranian UAV production centers, there's supposedly, I think, eight of them, And so they've invested very heavily in this, despite the economic challenges that I mentioned before. And they're trying to compensate for the technology and other things that the Air Force doesn't have. And these UAVs are much easier to produce. Some of the main parts are still imported from countries. But they've identified these eight industries in Iran which are responsible for manufacturing them. And some of them become more and more advanced. And they are providing them then for Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and the Kurdish region, where they give it to the Quds Force and others to use these the drones. So it is not a simple thing of having just an additional weapon. It's a very critical one. And we know that they've used them in Syria. We know that they've used them in other areas, particularly in the Gulf.
Quickly, Malcolm, Hamas is making statements about the ruin and abuse of Israel when it conquers Israel. At the same time, you tell me 10,000 people in Gaza have applied for work permits in Israel. Is there a separation between the people of Gaza and the leadership of Hamas?
I think that's a very good point. I think that is exactly right, that there is this division. It is, in fact, tens of thousands of people in Gaza, Palestinians, who lined up last Wednesday to get permits to work inside Israel. When a rumor circulated that more would be issued, and they said Israelis have said they decided to allow in 7,000 merchants in September, and they issued 4,500 permits because that's all they were able to get to, and now talking about the remaining 2,500. But the word spread, and you see that where the people are at versus where Hamas, which undertook under Haniyeh's own auspices this conference that Memory reported, where they talked about, I think it was called Promise of the Hereafter, Post-Liberation Palestine. And it was a Sinwar of Gaza who organized it, and senior officials from Hamas and other groups attended. And they talked there literally about the destruction of Israel and which Jews would be allowed to live, which would be killed, which would be forced to stay. Educated Jews in medicine, engineering, technology would not be allowed to leave. And the names of those who would be targeted in an effort to purge Palestine and the Arab homeland, et cetera. Language that is really Nazi-like. And yet the reaction in the international community is nil. When you talk about the defunct state and the plans for killing and expelling the population, I think it's something that tells you what the kind of enemy that Israel is facing.
Also, Malcolm, pay to slay, one of the most unacceptable conducts of the Palestinian Authority. What has the Biden administration proposed about the pay to slay?
Well, Hadi Amer, the Assistant Secretary of State, was there, and he held discussions with Palestinian leadership about a variety of issues. They keep pressing, I think, human rights and conditions, but he was pressing them on the pay to slay, and it's estimated last year $185 million out of the Palestinian budget was paid to terrorists, and the more they kill, the more they get, and this goes to the families of those who were killed or to the prisoners themselves, and they make much more than they would make were they to be working in a regular job.
Right.
$185 million to set aside. As you know, Israel deducts that amount from the monies they pass on to them, even though they gave them a $150 million loan. So people are saying you're undermining the pressure for pay to slay.
Is the conversation going forward? We have just a few seconds.
No. Basically, Abbas has been really an obstacle. He will not negotiate on this. And by the way, the Europeans and others are also cutting their aid, as have most of the Arab countries, because of this and the kleptocracy and the mismanagement, et cetera.
Malcolm Hohenlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. Abbas in the 16th year of his 4-year term. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.